I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is the Trans-Canada Highway. One of Canada's major post-Second World War infrastructure projects, the Trans-Canada Highway links the country together from east to west. First opening in 1960, and in the 65 years since then, millions and millions of people have not only driven on part of the Trans-Canada Highway, but have done the whole distance from coast to coast. But of course, the history of the Trans-Canada Highway and its construction is quite an interesting story, particularly when you're thinking about the logistics of building this highway, ensuring that there's a continuity from coast to coast when you're dealing with municipalities and provinces, as well as the federal government. Very fascinating decisions about where the highway would go, what communities would be included, what communities would not be included. And then, of course, the story of what happens to those individuals who are actually driving along the Trans-Canada Highway, both for interprovincial travel, but also those who use it on a day-to-day basis, as in a lot of cities, the Trans-Canada Highway is part of major commuting networks. So it really is a fascinating tale of transportation in this country, and it is the subject of a new book by Craig Baird entitled Canada's Main Street, The Epic Story of the Trans-Canada Highway, in which Craig goes through and talks about the development of the Trans-Canada Highway as an infrastructure project, gets into some of the challenges that came along with funding the project, getting agreement from the various levels of government, the fascinating stories of the politics behind where the Trans-Canada Highway would go, what would be included, what wouldn't be included, and of course, how regional realities played into its construction and usage. If you just think of the prairies, relatively flat, with the large population centers somewhat concentrated in various parts of the region compared to, say, British Columbia, where the topography makes construction a lot more difficult and a lot harder to link together some of those major population centers. So really some interesting tales, some interesting stories, and interesting background that goes into the construction and the planning of the Trans-Canada Highway. And then, of course, the ultimate use of the Trans-Canada Highway by Canadians and visitors from all over the world. So I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to talk to Craig. You're probably familiar with his work on Canada History X, wonderful podcast, and he's a really good public historian. He's out and talking on a lot of issues related to Canadian history. So there's a very good chance that you've come across Craig and his work in some capacity. So a very busy guy. I was very lucky that he had some time to talk to me. So let's get right into my chat with Craig Baird. All right. And Craig Baird joins me now. Craig, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today to talk about Canada's Main Street. As I said in the intro, book about the Trans-Canada Highway. And let's just, before we get into some of the specifics about the book, you mentioned in the introduction how there's a lot of stuff in the literature about the CPR, but not really anything about the Trans-Canada Highway. So why do you think that the railroad has taken this really romantic place in Canadian history, whereas the highway doesn't really garner the same attention?
Well, I think it's kind of the opposite of, what is it, the recency bias, where, you know, something that is more recent, people tend to, you know more about. I think with the CPR, what's happened is, because it's something that we don't use as much anymore, it's something that is in the past. I mean, obviously, we still have trains running on the CPR lines and everything, but we're not using it as a society anymore as much as we did decades ago, where that was how we got across the country. And I think that it gives it that historical aspect to it. Plus, there's other parts to it with nation building, with BC coming in, with John A. Macdonald, all of that kind of helping to make it this grand story. And so when people look at the Trans-Canada Highway, they just see a highway. You know, if you live in Calgary, you want to go to a place like Peter's Drive-In, you drive on 16th Avenue, that's the Trans-Canada Highway. And people just don't think about it because it's just there. But it, you know, it's something that took a long time to build. It cost a lot. It took a great deal of cooperation to make it happen. And it's just something that kind of flies under the radar quite a bit.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, here in Ottawa, where I am, the 416 is part of the Trans-Canada Highway, and it's jammed every day, and people get mad at it, right? It's not, you don't have this romantic vision of it. Do you think part of it is also, you know, in the late 19th century, as you mentioned, this is a time Canada is new as a nation. The idea of banding together east-west is still very much a thing. Provinces are joining Confederation. And then as the Trans-Canada Highway is being built, this is the era where I would say it didn't necessarily start in the post-Second World War era, but a lot of the focus is on Canada and the United States and becoming more cooperative and more integrated in the North-South relationship. Do you think that has any part in just maybe the lack of romantic idealism about the Trans-Canada Highway?
I definitely think that is part of it, because like you said, after the Second World War, we were starting to think more north-south rather than east-west. And so the Trans-Canada Highway does play into that. The Trans-Canada Highway in many ways feels like an afterthought. It's something like, oh, you know, we should probably have a highway that goes across the country. It doesn't have that same cachet of like, let's build something that unites the country together and brings all the provinces in and promotes settlement and, you know, all of that with the CPR. And then the Trans-Canada Highway, you know, it's also being overshadowed by other projects that are going on at the time, like St. Lawrence Seaway, which, you know, is a gigantic project, you know, has a huge impact on Canada and our economy. And like you said, yeah, it definitely was. We were just kind of, well, we should build a highway. You know, we've got to promote tourism, things like that. The United States has highways going across their country. We should be doing the same. But it didn't really have this grand vision. It was something, it was, you know, we should do it. Let's get it done. And there wasn't like a huge hurry to do it.
Is there anything associated to like the CPR, this idea, right? Railroads are the new thing and new technology is going to band the whole country together. But, you know, in the Trans-Canada Highway example, we already have, say, the Alaska Highway that was already built, and these major projects, and people are already familiar with roads. So in the research you were doing, was there any sense at the time of, okay, just another infrastructure project?
It kind of was like, even in the, you know, the federal side of it, there wasn't a lot of, you know, debate of like, should we do this? It was like, yeah, let's get this done. Let's build this. It was more about how we pay for it, how much each province and the federal government pays for it. But yeah, I think that it was just a case of that. It was after the Second World War, you know, cars were becoming more plentiful. It was just, you know, the roads were kind of everywhere, but they weren't great roads. If you wanted to drive somewhere, especially cross country, they said you'd have to bring several spare tires because you're going to have a lot of flats as you go. And I think it was also, there was probably a tiny bit of pride in it, because anybody coming to Canada would see the state of our roads and, you know, doesn't quite look like, you know, a developed nation would have for roads. A lot of them aren't paved. And again, there's a lot of people looking at it as, well, do we really need this? Because I can take the train across the country. Right. And so in many ways, the Trans-Canada Highway is between those two eras of the train travel era from before the 1950s and then the automobile era afterwards. And it was like, yeah, just something that kind of an afterthought in many ways. And like I said, there wasn't a huge hurry to make it happen. That's probably why it took so long when you compare to building the majority of the CPR, where it only took less than a decade. Building the Trans-Canada Highway took upwards of 20 years, and places like Newfoundland were, you know, kind of stalling and delaying it quite a bit because it didn't seem like it was this huge national dream type thing.
Right. And how much of the initial conception of the highway is localized traffic patterns compared to the big national idea of, all right, here we're going to have a highway, you're going to be able to drive all the way across the country, which you've done. We'll talk about that in a bit. But also because, again, as you say, in Ottawa, it's the main route in and out of downtown for a lot of folks who live east and west in the city. Like, as the planning process is going on, late 1940s, how much of the discussion is, well, what are the local realities? What are the local requirements compared to the grand national vision of linking all of these places together?
Yeah, I mean, a big difference with this and the CPR is when they were building the CPR, we were kind of creating the communities as we went. I mean, Calgary wasn't a very big place, and then the CPR comes through and explodes. With the Trans-Canada Highway, these big cities are already there. And it's a matter of which ones are we building through. And so in Eastern Canada, especially in Atlantic Canada, there isn't as much debate of like which communities is it going to go through, because, you know, the Atlantic provinces aren't huge. It can hit most of those communities. And then especially as you get through into Ontario, you know, does it go through Toronto? Does it go through Ottawa? Do we go down to Southern Ontario? Which way do we take? Northern Ontario or over Lake Superior? But it especially gets kind of dicey when you get to a place like Alberta, because in Alberta, we have three different routes that it can take into BC. It has two routes coming in from Saskatchewan. And one of those routes in Alberta is Edmonton, the capital. And then the other is Calgary. And then even farther south is Lethbridge. And so it's deciding, you know, which way are we going? So it did take into consideration a lot of the local needs of the various cities, but also, you know, is it going to go through a national park? For a province, they wanted to go through a national park because the federal government's paying 100% of that cost. So you want to make sure that it's going through, say, Banff, rather than a place that doesn't have a national park and you got to pay to build it, you know, to the Star of the Rockies before British Columbia takes over. So the localized concerns definitely dictated a lot of where that highway was going to be. Coming through Saskatchewan, you know, is it going to go through Regina? Well, most likely. But at that point, does it go north to Saskatoon to hit both communities? If it does, now Edmonton's got to be the community that takes it. But does it continue west from Edmonton or does it go back south to Calgary? So there was all these matters of which communities as a go through, where are we going to get the most bang for our buck, especially when it comes to tourism and Americans coming up from the border.
Right. And then you have a city like Moose Jaw, who's probably sitting there like, well, what about us? Right. Like, so yeah. You know, there are a lot of considerations along the way. So as we're going through, and again, in this initial planning stage, one of the things, and this is coming up certainly right now with the idea of interprovincial planning, national projects, how difficult it can be to get things through. What were the initial stages then of how is this funded? How is it going through the various levels of government to determine things like routing and construction costs? And what was that process like?
Well, the route and essentially the highway cost, that's all provincial matters. So it was really a lot of the province doing a lot of the heavy lifting with that. The federal government, in order to get this done, obviously they knew they had to take on a cost and a part of it, but they were kind of just the overarching, you know, looking at it, here's the money, almost like giving out grants in a way, whereas the provinces are incorporating that into their highway budgets for the year. When they first start in 1949, they signed the Trans-Canada Highway Act. The agreement is 50-50, except in national parks where the federal government will pay the entire cost. Now, like I said, all the parties were in favor of this highway being built, but the Progressive Conservatives wanted the federal government to take the entire cost. You also had an election at the same time. So you have this unique situation where candidates say in Edmonton and candidates in Calgary are like, don't worry, we're going to get the highway built through here. And they're candidates for the same party. And it's like, well, one of you's lying because it can't go through both. And so as it's, you know, as it's signed and they say, okay, we're going to have this done by 1956, which is a pipe dream. Saskatchewan is the only one that even comes close to getting it done in 1956. And as they start to get in 1956, they have to renegotiate because it's not going to be completed. Newfoundland has barely even started. Quebec hasn't even signed on to it yet. And they won't until Maurice Duplessis passes away in 1959 and the Quiet Revolution begins. So once 1956 comes along, then they agree. The federal government says, okay, we're still going to do 50-50, but through the 10% most difficult portion in your province, we will pay 90% of the cost. And that helps speed things up quite a bit. You do have other places like Newfoundland, which holds out to the point where the federal government pretty much pays for the entire construction of that highway and gets it done in 1965. So that was really where the federal government was involved in how it was doling out the money. And then everything else, that was up to the provinces. They had to communicate, they had to agree where the highway was going to go, how it was going to connect, all of that. And the federal government would also dictate the requirements of the highway, how large it would be, how big the shoulders would be and such.
Right. Was it an actual election issue in 1949? Certainly, yes. As you mentioned, it would come up in local things. But was it something that actually, you think, moved voters in one way or the other in that 49 election?
I think it might have a little bit. The issue, again, was it wasn't a case of the federal or, you know, say you have a progressive conservative candidate against a liberal candidate. Well, both agree that the highway should be built and they're just disagreeing on where it should be built. But even, like I said, within the same party, you had candidates saying, we'll build it through here. If we get elected, it's coming through Edmonton. And if we get elected, it's going through Lethbridge. And again, you can't build it through both. So it wasn't a huge election issue. It definitely did focus part of the election on it. But again, it was just a lot of promises being made about exactly where it's going to go. And one candidate saying, I'm going to fight to get it through here. And another candidate said, I'm going to fight to get it through here. So you're essentially agreeing on the exact same thing.
Right. And I'm interested too in this reluctance that you talked about, or resistance from Quebec and Newfoundland. And I would argue that those are probably the two provinces that have the most distinctive identities. Maybe some folks out west might argue with me on that, but you know, certainly, and in 1949, there's a lot of folks in Newfoundland who just don't want to be part of Canada, forget an infrastructure project. And the story of Quebec is certainly well written. And do you see that in other parts of the country as well, though, where there is forms of resistance or people saying more like, well, this is ours, just give us the money and leave us alone, federal government. And this is part of like our project. This is, you know, Alberta's highway. This is Saskatchewan's highway. This is New Brunswick's highway. Yeah, it's going to be interconnected. That's all well and good, but this is ours.
You didn't see it too much out west. It was more just give us as much money as possible so we can build this. And, you know, we don't have to be taxing our citizens too much to build it. So just hand over as much as you can so we can have this built. And like you said, probably the two areas where it was the most difficult, like Nova Scotia took a little bit longer because they just took longer to determine where it was going to go. But once the Canso Causeway was agreed upon, then it was like, okay, well, we know exactly where it's going to go. The federal government's going to help pay for this cost to build that causeway. But in Newfoundland and Quebec, it was delayed quite a bit, and it came down to really the premier. So in Newfoundland, you had Joey Smallwood, and he kind of ran things with, you know, almost like a dictator in some ways. And, you know, he really pushed the federal government to pay most of the cost, because also Newfoundland, like you said, was a relatively new province it was a brand new province in 1949. And before that, they were under colonial rule because they had gone bankrupt in the 1930s. So they weren't flush with cash. So they really did need the federal government to pay a lot of the cost. And that was kind of a slogan, was the drive for 65 to get it built in 1965, which they did. In Quebec, it was a little bit different because Maurice Duplessis was another person who kind of held the province in an iron grip. And he reasoned that we already have a very good highway running from Quebec City to Montreal and into Ontario. We don't need to be part of this scheme. We don't need to make the shoulders a certain size. He argued that doing that would cause the destruction of various homes and things like that. So he definitely kind of held a tight grip on that. And then he dies in 1959. And that's when Quebec starts to go through a massive transformation with the Quiet Revolution. You start to move into getting Expo 67. And then we start to see that, oh, we need to have a good highway so people can go to things like Expo 67. We have the centennial coming up in 1967. We want people to drive across the country. And the federal government agrees to do a lot of very big projects on the highway in Quebec, especially in Montreal, to get it built. And so it was just more the premiers holding out in Quebec and Newfoundland, you know, rather than the people. I think the people would have been very happy to have a nice highway built through, especially in Newfoundland. It's a kind of a double-edged sword in Newfoundland, though, because you have this highway that's built, and that spells the end of what's called the Newfie Bullet, which was this train that went kind of the same route that the highway did. It was gone within a couple of years of the highway being built, and a lot of people felt that was an unfortunate loss. And you do see that in other areas. As soon as the highway is built, you start to see the rail traffic decreasing quite a bit as we move into a new age.
Right. And that makes sense, as it's easier to get around in your own car than you have a car where you're going. And it's, yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. So you mentioned that there initially the idea was 1956 to finish it. Where did that number come from? Why was the estimate 1956? Because that, as you sort of chuckled as you said, it seems ludicrous to be able to do it in 1956. And yeah, the CPR is different in how quickly it was built, but also the labor situation was different at that time, the way it was built, all that, routing things. Like, where did they come up with this estimate of 1956? And were there people at the time saying, no chance?
I think there were quite a few people who were saying this isn't feasible. And like you said, with the CPR, it was the federal government mostly saying, we're building it through here, and this is where it's going to go. With the Trans-Canada Highway, it was a very different situation. And I think, like, it's my own hunch they chose 1956 because it was 8 years from 7 years from 1949 to 1956. And if you look at the building of the CPR, obviously there was a little bit that was being built in the early 1870s, and then it kind of just stops from 1873 to 1878 when Alexander Mackenzie and the Liberals are in power. And then once Sir John Macdonald comes back into power in 1878, then it starts ramping up again, and it finishes in 1885. So it's 7 years, you know, from when he comes back into power to when it's finished. So there's part of me that believes that they're like, well, if we can build the CPR in that amount of time, surely we can build a road in that same amount of time. But it was much more difficult. And it took a few years for some places just to agree on where the route was going to be because it was left to the provinces. And, you know, you don't actually see it truly being finished until 1970, 1971. So it took so much longer to actually get it built. And 1956 was not feasible at all. And then they just kept kind of moving the goalpost. And as you did, more provinces would finish. Obviously, the prairies are the first to finish because it's relatively easy to build. And then places like BC are much more difficult. You have a lot of bridges. I think Saskatchewan had like one or two bridges that had to be built, and British Columbia had like 15 that had to be built.
Yeah, and you have to do a lot more grading in BC versus the prairies, and same in Northern Ontario as well, going through rocks and all that kind of, like, it's just a different environmental situation for sure. But given that, were there things like today, of course, projects have to go through environmental assessments and you'd want indigenous consultation, depending on where the routing is and when we're taking up land. Is there any hint to those sorts of processes as well in terms of the execution of it? And does that account for any of the length that it took to get this done?
There wasn't, in terms of what we would see now, you know, where you would see a lot of consultation with First Nations, especially environmental considerations. It was more or less, let's build it through here and, you know, we'll figure. And you would see like areas where that get a lot of rain suddenly being flooded out because they built through. The reason there wasn't a lot of that, though, is because they were kind of just building on roads that were already there in most cases, especially in the prairies where it was just building onto a dirt road and expanding it and improving on it. Through northern Ontario, you know, over Lake Superior, they did have to build through the area at that point. But again, there wasn't a lot of consultation in terms of First Nations. In fact, there was a First Nations village, I think it was just outside of Winnipeg, and it felt like it was unsightly along the Trans-Canada Highway. So they actually just moved it with everybody to another area where it couldn't be seen from the Trans-Canada Highway, which would be something that I don't imagine you would ever see now, but you definitely saw it back then. But there wasn't a lot of like consideration for wildlife or anything like that. It was just build it through. And I think part of that is they were looking at the Alaska Highway and how this huge highway is built in the course of about, you know, 9 or 10 months. And that was just by essentially taking bulldozers and just bulldozing everything in the way. And they were kind of taking that same mentality with the building of the Trans-Canada Highway.
Do we see any displacement across the country of communities, individuals, anything like that on a major scale, like full-on communities?
Not really. The most you saw was in certain cities, especially in Montreal, where they're building big interchanges and things like that that required the bulldozing of some neighborhoods to make these interchanges. You saw in some other areas where they were widening the highway, some of the houses along the way had to be bulldozed, but nothing like where you would see an entire community being displaced. Often the highway would go south of a community or north of a community, other than in major cities like Ottawa or Calgary, where it's going straight through the community. Obviously, now there are ring roads because people realize they didn't want to go on a Trans-Canada Highway journey and hit rush hour in the middle of a city. They want to bypass it. But you would see it go north or south, and that's when you start to see things like the Wawa Goose and, you know, Mac the Moose being built, because it's taking people off the highway, take a picture, now go into to the community that's only 2 or 3 kilometers to the south. And that's when you start to see those roadside attractions, because the highway was always kind of like just outside of the community limits to be built.
Yeah, the premise of one of the greatest Corner Gas episodes, or one of my favorites. World's Biggest Hoe, yeah. really brilliant there. So in the book, you go through it and you discuss the situation all across the country. Is there one place that really stood out to you where the highway and the process of building it was whether more contentious or more community involvement or had a bigger impact than maybe expected? Like, is there one place for you that really stands out across the country?
Yeah, actually, it's a place that the highway wasn't actually built through. So I'm just outside of Edmonton in a town called Stony Plain. And Edmonton fought so hard to get this highway. Like, it had a whole association built up, the Yellowhead Association. They sent caravans to, or they were going to send a caravan to Ottawa, but never did. But they sent caravans to like Jasper and Revelstoke and Kamloops to say, look, look, we can actually drive from Edmonton all the way here right now on the road we have. We just need this improved. The Trans-Canada Highway should go through here. And even though everybody knew there was a foregone conclusion, it was probably going to go through Calgary because you wanted that traffic going into Banff, especially with Americans coming up, plus the national parks and all of that. The other option was it could go through Lethbridge, through the Crow's Nest Pass, which was a very good highway at the time. But even though it was, everybody knew that it wasn't going to go through Edmonton because it was going to go through Regina and probably just continue to the west, and it can't just zigzag up and hit every community that wants to have it. So even though they were in a losing cause, and even after it was announced the highway was going through Calgary, Edmonton was still fighting to get this highway. And, you know, I admire their pluckiness and trying to get this highway, even though everybody knew it wasn't going to happen. I mean, we kind of do now have that highway because the Yellowhead is part of the Trans-Canada Highway Network, not the actual Trans-Canada though. But I just like that part of the story with how Edmonton fought and fought and fought, probably more than any other community in Canada, to get that highway built through.
And of course the book goes through and discusses the process and all of this. And we won't get into all the fine details that are in the book here, but of course the comparison early on in the book is with the CPR. Everyone, I think, listening to this would know the photo of the last spike and that big ceremonial moment. What do we have for the Trans-Canada Highway? Is there any real acknowledgement when it finishes? Is it the same moment of celebration, or is it just, well, get the paver off the road so people can drive on it?
Yeah, like you said, you have the last spike, this very famous photo. Everybody knows it, but nobody really knows the photo of John Diefenbaker tamping down the asphalt in Rogers Pass. And that's a very much kind of goes with the story of the Trans-Canada Highway, where it doesn't kind of get the maybe the respect it deserves. And even with that, with the federal government saying the highway's open in 1962, you still had Newfoundland still working on it. I mean, Quebec had just signed on, and you had various parts that were still just dirt roads. So technically there was a road across the country, but it wasn't like to the specifications of a Trans-Canada Highway. There were dirt roads, there were gravel roads that made this up, and it wouldn't be finished for a number of years. And then a few months before John Diefenbaker did that in the Rogers Pass, British Columbia, which was mad about the amount of money that was given to them for the building of the highway because they felt they should get more because of how much work it is to build through the mountains, held their own ceremony to open the Trans-Canada Highway very close to where John Diefenbaker would do it a few months later. So you had two ceremonies for opening the Trans-Canada Highway, one on the provincial level, one on the federal level. And I think, you know, a lot of people just don't even think that there's nothing to really, I think there might be something maybe to market, but nothing like you see with the CPR and this iconic image. And, you know, it's in every textbook about Canadian history, but not really for John Diefenbaker and tamping down that highway and declaring that it's open, even though technically it wasn't even finished yet.
Right. Well, I mean, the reality too of roads in this country is, okay, you finish it, but there's probably parts of it that have already been torn up and repaved, and there's other parts that are exactly, giant potholes. Like, yeah. You're not like road work is never really done anywhere in Canada. There's always more work to be done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm curious what you think about, and this is always a dangerous thing of sort of the counterfactual history, but you know, this is an era, the 50s and 60s, where we do see the real, I don't know if it's a transition to vehicles, but there's a real expansion of the use of personal vehicles in North America, at least. Is the Trans-Canada product a result of that trend already moving and the government responding to it? Or is this a case of the government perhaps taking the lead and the market responding to greater accessibility of individual transportation?
I think it's kind of both, because you did have people, you know, trying to drive across the country beforehand. I had what was called the Todd Medal, which was created in 1910, and it was going to be presented to whoever drove across the country completely within the country, not using water or the railroad to transport a car. And in 1910, it was created, and they expected to be awarded by 1915. It wasn't awarded till 1946. So, wow. we definitely were kind of slow on the uptick, of building a highway system. Like provinces, certain provinces had excellent highway systems. Manitoba had a very good one, but there wasn't anything kind of linking everything. So I think it was kind of the trend was already there for people starting to use automobiles more and more after the Second World War, more disposable income. It's wild to me to think that like back then it was, a Sunday afternoon, let's go for a drive. Whereas like now people are like, I don't want to drive anywhere on a Sunday. Yeah. I just want to stay home. Yeah. But back then it was like, let's do a Sunday drive. That's a family activity. And so you started to see that more and more while the Trans-Canada is being built. So I think it was kind of both ends where the federal government's like, well, we should build this highway. And then people are like, hey, that highway is being built. Let's explore the country. So they were just kind of going hand in hand at that point.
That's interesting that a metal like that would be created in 1910, where there isn't, as you say, the system that's really interconnected. Also, what was the provision for PEI to get that metal? If you can't use water and you got to do the whole country.
That's a good point. I mean, you could add Victoria in that as well.
That's true. Vancouver Island. Yeah.
It was more just like driving from
Ocean to ocean.
Vancouver to Halifax. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I guess if you can dip your.
Because eventually you got to pass water, like at some point.
At some point. I mean, both sides of the country have islands on them. And then once you had Newfoundland in 1949, then we're really pretty far afield. Now, as I said, you've done this. You've driven the Trans-Canada Highway, as you mentioned in the introduction of the book. Now, having done the book and having driven the whole thing, what do you think the meaning of the road is? I mean, as I say, for me, when I'm on it, don't really recognize that I'm on the Trans-Canada Highway that much, just sort of exists. But for someone who's done the whole thing, maybe it means something else to you. And as someone who has done this book and done a lot of research on it, like what does the road mean to you and what does it symbolize for the country?
Well, it definitely means more now that I've written the book and done the research and all of that. So when I get onto the Trans-Canada Highway, it's like, oh, this is what I was writing about. And all these people work to build this clear across the country. And it's really amazing that like you can get onto the Trans-Canada Highway, say in Calgary, and stay on that road and drive all the way to Halifax. Mm-hmm. And we don't really think that much about it, but you know, the Trans-Canada Highway is a great way to explore the country. Everybody will fly everywhere, but when you take something like the Trans-Canada Highway and even branch off from the highway to the secondary roads and, you know, see what little things you can find, little small town diners or historical attractions or things like that. So for me, it definitely takes on a different meaning when I'm on the highway and thinking like, I've written about, you know, this spot here where people were working and, you know, the history that's involved in that. And then the Trans-Canada Highway for Canada, again, we don't think too much about it, but it is very much interwoven in our culture and our history. I mean, Terry Fox ran on the Trans-Canada Highway and Rick Hansen was on the Trans-Canada Highway with his Man in Motion tour. And, you know, there's all these other stories with the Trans-Canada Highway that are part of our history that we don't really think about. We think of the story of that person or the event, but not the role the highway played in it. And that's not the case with the CPR, where the CPR is part of the story. You know, if you're talking about the Northwest Resistance or something and troops on the CPR going to what's now Saskatchewan, it definitely is playing a part in that. And it is part of the story. But when we talk about Terry Fox, we talk about the Marathon of Hope and all the distance he ran, but we don't talk about the fact that he was able to do that on a highway that was built, you know, and finished really only a decade earlier.
And I don't know how much of it is related then to the story of the labor behind it, because with the CPR, the labor certainly isn't disassociated with the railway, right? We think about, or it's taught, the labor that went into it. One, the people who came to Canada to build the thing, the treatment that they received. So that's really front and center. Even the last spike is representative of that, of the work that goes into building a railway. I feel like with the Trans-Canada Highway, with roads in general, the labor associated with it is largely disassociated with it. We just think we're just driving on this thing. We don't think about the people who did the work to actually build the road. And I wonder if that's partly in this case because it is so decentralized in terms of who's doing it. It's not like the same crew is going across the country in a similar way that we saw with the CPR. But for you, is that part, how important is that part of the story? Like, yes, it's critical how we use it, the way it brings people together. Certainly, you talk in the book about shipping, the amount of trucks who use it. But what about the labor that went into it and the individuals who put this, who actually did the construction to get this road done?
I think a big problem with the Trans-Canada Highway is that we don't have any grand figures related to it. I mean, with CPR, you can say you have Sir John A. Macdonald, you have especially somebody like Sir Sanford Fleming, who is a big flamboyant figure who's surveying it. And you have these amazing stories of, you know, going through the mountains and choosing the route and all of that. You have the stories of the Chinese workers who, you know, in that famous photo, were all pushed out of the photo and aren't there, even though they're critical to getting it built in British Columbia. And when we look at the Trans-Canada Highway, I think a reason we don't really think about the labor is because highways are everywhere. And so we don't think about, you know, the guy who was out there in 35 degree heat laying asphalt and such, or sitting in a tractor, or some of the people who did die because of accidents that happened. And we just don't look at that aspect to it. I mean, there's, I think, two Heritage Minutes about the CPR. There's none about the Trans-Canada Highway, unless you count the Terry Fox one, I guess. But so, yeah, I think it's, you know, we don't really look at the labor that was involved in it. It involved a lot of people working. And obviously, it was not a case of like people, like you said, somebody started in Thunder Bay and they worked all the way to Vancouver. It was localized. It was local companies in each province working on different portions of it. It wasn't a whole bunch of people just kind of laying track every day, like with the CPR and just advancing to the west. It was various contracts and like, okay, we got our 100 kilometers done. Now this company is taking over.
Right. And maybe that is actually more representative of what the country really is. So certainly in the 20th century, it's each province, each city, each municipality is doing its thing and coming together and creating this country and whatever it looks like at various places from coast to coast to coast, right? Maybe that is more of a better analogy for what Canada actually is.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was a changing world. We were a variety of communities. We were a variety of provinces. When the CPR was built, there was no Alberta, Saskatchewan, and in many cases, Manitoba was much, much smaller. So, you know, all those things weren't there. And then when you're building the Trans-Canada Highway, you do see those, all these communities being involved. You see, you know, I'd be reading stories about a family where the father was working on one of the crews that was going past their community. And then once it was past their community, they were back to doing whatever they did in the community. And so it was very localized. It was all these little islands of workers and people all kind of working together to make this happen. And then you go up a level and you have the municipalities that are working together. And then up another level, you have the provinces that have to agree on everything. And then up another level to the federal government. And like you said, it's very representative of Canada at that time.
Yeah, so a very fascinating story and a very good book. Again, it's called Canada's Main Street, The Epic Story of the Trans-Canada Highway. Craig, if people want to pick up a copy of the book, of course, you got the podcast as well. What's the best way for them to follow along with everything you got going on?
We can follow the podcast. It's Canadian History X, and that's EHX. It's available on all podcast platforms. You can also follow me on social media. Just more or less search for Canadian History X, and you will find me. I'm tweeting every day and posting every day. And then for the book, just look for the book at most bookstores. You can find it online through Sutherland House Books or Amazon. Pretty much anywhere you find books, you can probably find this book.
And we will link to the podcast and to the Sutherland book, the page for the book on Sutherland down in the show notes below. So be sure to check those out. Craig, thanks so much for joining me today. Really enjoyed it.
No, thanks for having me.
So here you have it, my chat with Craig Baird, and I thank him for his time. Again, the book is Canada's Main Street, The Epic Story of the Trans-Canada Highway. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from Sioux Today, which is, of course, a publication from Sault Ste. Marie. And this is actually a news release from the Federation of Northern Ontario Municipalities entitled "Ontario is the Weakest Link in the Trans-Canada Highway," group says. And this is a statement from this Association of Municipalities, which is calling on both the provincial and federal governments to modernize the Trans-Canada Highway across Northern Ontario. So in Northern Ontario, those are highways 11 and 17 that are part of the Trans-Canada Highway, and they are calling on the federal and provincial governments to improve it. The primary issue that the municipalities point to in this is that for much of Northern Ontario, the Trans-Canada Highway remains two lanes, whereas for a lot of the other sections of the Trans-Canada Highway, you have four lanes separated in a lot of parts of the country as well. But in Northern Ontario, you have a lot of places that are only two. And I should say, I did my undergraduate at Nipissing University and have driven on Highway 11 a lot over the years. And when it gets down to two lanes, it is rather annoying. And there are safety issues, of course, particularly in the winter time, and when there are traffic disruptions, when there are issues, a lot of trucks go along the Trans-Canada Highway through Northern Ontario. And what they're saying in this release is that $200 million worth of goods every day travel along the Northern Ontario section of the Trans-Canada Highway. So they are proposing the widening of the highway in certain places, twinning in other places, the two-in-one highway to improve safety, reduce costs, and minimize environmental impacts along the 3,000-kilometer corridor from Quebec to Manitoba. Of course, this is in the context of the federal government and its push towards big infrastructure projects, big projects across the country. So the Federation of Northern Ontario Municipalities is calling on the federal government to push this forward in that vein, along with the provincial government. So in the context of what Craig was talking about, some of the challenges associated with where did the Trans-Canada Highway go? What did different cities want? What did different provinces want? Here's an interesting example of here we are in 2025, and you have these municipalities in Northern Ontario still calling for this similar thing that we saw during the initial construction, that things in their area, their region, not up to par, need to be fully addressed. So it's interesting that as this highway has had such a powerful and unique history throughout Canadian history, we have this environment here where, as with all roads across the country, needs to be updated, needs to be maintained all the time. And here we have the Federation of Northern Ontario Municipalities getting in on that very long tradition as it relates to the Trans-Canada Highway. So today's historical headline of the week from Sue Today on August 25th, 2025, a news release from the Federation of Northern Ontario Municipalities. Ontario is the weakest link in the Trans-Canada Highway, group says. And with that, I'll say thank you so much for listening, everybody. We are back from our summer hiatus, calling this season three on the show. Very excited for what we got coming up through the fall. We got some stuff already recorded, some stuff in partnership with our friends over at Carleton University and the Shannon Lecture Series that we're very excited about. But of course, as always, if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, it's oldisnews@gmail.com. And please do subscribe if you have not yet. Do all the likes, ratings, all that good stuff. Helps other people find the show. Keeps us growing. So thanks again so much, everybody, for listening. We'll be back with you again next week for more What's Old is News.